This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Thanks for being with us on this Veterans Day.
This morning, East Berlin presents an eerie picture. Communist troops in force on every street corner. Soldiers of the Communist National Army drawn up along the sector boundary with columns of armored cars, and behind them, by the tens of thousands, the workers' militia in their sloppy brown uniforms and visored caps, bearing an uncanny resemblance to the stormtroopers of Adolf Hitler.
2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was, Civis Romanus sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner.
We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
They are celebrating on the East German side. There are hundreds of East German police in paramilitary uniforms. They appear to be unarmed. They're doing nothing but watching.
Moments there from the life of the Berlin Wall. Constructed in 1961, the wall effectively and ideologically divided the city of Berlin in half and served as the official border between West Germany and the communist government of the German Democratic Republic. During the years of the wall, about 5,000 people successfully defected to West Berlin. The number of people who died trying to cross the wall is still a matter of dispute, but most historians put the figure at about 140 people. In 1989, as popular revolts spread through Eastern Europe, GDR control of the wall gave way, and on November 9th, border crossings were officially opened, and thousands joyously breached the border. Today on the show, some moments of significance for our nation and its military, starting with 1961. Andrew Nagorski spent more than three decades as a foreign correspondent and editor for Newsweek and covered the upheavals of 1989 and 1990 in Europe. He's the author of seven books, most recently 1941, The Year Germany Lost the War. And I asked him to bring us back to the wall's beginnings.
Berlin was in the Soviet zone, but it too was divided in four ways. And very soon, huge numbers of people, East Germans, East Berliners, and others from other parts of East Germany were crossing into West Berlin, and that effectively got them into the West, into West Germany, because from there they could take flights and find other ways to go into the Western world. And during that period of from the time East Germany became a state in 1948 until 1961, when they started building the wall, by most estimates, about 3.5 million East Germans had gone west, many of them through to West Berlin, and it was just the place was imploding, and that's when they suddenly constructed this monstrosity that effectively surrounded West Berlin. We think of the wall as dividing the city, but it also, since this was an island in East Germany, it made West Berlin an island there that was surrounded by walls and barriers.
Tell us about the different perceptions of the wall, or how the wall was talked about on either side in West Berlin versus East Berlin.
Well, the East German government called it the anti-fascist barrier, as somehow that they were keeping out the West German fascists, as they called them. Of course, that was nonsense. West Germans referred to it as the Wall of Shame. It became, of course, very quickly the symbol of the Cold War. And it was especially galling, I think, for many East Berliners who were so close to an island of freedom in West Berlin, but not to be able to cross into it. They could sometimes watch it on TV. They could hear the radios. They could even hear the sounds across the Brandenburg Gate and other places when there were concerts and so forth. And yet, life in East Germany and East Berlin in particular was as bleak Soviet-style life. Shortages, repression, and so it became the embodiment of that whole conflict.
I remember watching news coverage as a little girl of the fall of the wall. And I think there are some folks that might assume that once the wall came down, if you will, that was it. So did communism. And that's not exactly as simple, is it?
Well, it's not exactly as simple, although that was because the images were so powerful. A lot of people think that was the major event of 1989. Of course, 1989 was a series of events. I call it a five-act play, where you had movements in other parts of the Eastern Bloc that had dislodged the system, in particular in Poland. The Poles had the Solidarity movement that had been revived, and by 1989, the communist economy was collapsing, popular protests were growing, and they forced the government to effectively negotiate with them and to allow for partially free elections, which the government thought, oh, well, we can keep this, that will give them some token seats and remain in power. But Solidarity won everything. And eventually they got defectors and took over the government, and first non-communist government. So that happens first. Then Hungary next door, which had always been considered the communist government, Hungary considered itself relatively progressive, and had in fact allowed some of its citizens to go back and forth to Austria next door, neutral Austria, and East German citizens, they could not travel west, but they could travel to what were called the fraternal socialist states, and Hungary was one of them. They discovered that that the Hungarians were taking down the border barriers between Austria and Hungary, and they started crossing into there, and that really created the pressure on the East Germans to do something, because there were then huge protests in East Berlin. 500,000 people in early November were out there in the streets of East Berlin. There were huge protests in Leipzig and other cities. And the East Germans thought, well, we can liberalize a little bit. They made a somewhat ambiguous announcement about relaxing travel regulations. It wasn't clear exactly when. And then that's what happened on November 9th, and everybody just said, okay, we're going across. We're not going to wait for clarifications. We're going across.
Now, let's talk about some of the other big players at the time. Mikhail Gorbachev, the Soviet premier.
Yes.
What was his take on what was happening?
There were several new factors in the 80s, new leaders. There had been the Polish Pope, John Paul II, that had helped inspire the events in Poland. You had Ronald Reagan, who had, of course, famously said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Gorbachev believed he could reform what he called the socialist system, the Soviet system, but keep Communist Party rule. And so the one thing that had prevented people of Eastern Europe from breaking away were Soviet tanks, or the threat of Soviet tanks. There have been numerous attempts in the past, the Hungarian uprising, the what was called the Prague Spring in the 60s. And each time Soviet tanks had put it down, or local communist authorities, as they did in Poland in various protests. But Gorbachev basically said, I'm going to allow everyone to make some reforms and try to make their people happier and no longer threaten them with massive force. What he did not understand, that once you began to loosen all that and the fear wasn't there, then the momentum of these protest movements, which had been organizing throughout the 80s, throughout the region, became so powerful that it was impossible to stop. So I think Gorbachev's role in history he deserves credit for only, there were a few smaller uses of force, but not massive use of force. But he did not understand the dynamic that he was unleashing.
You mentioned that very famous moment of Ronald Reagan saying, tear down this wall. And at the time that the wall finally came down, George Bush was president, Father Bush, right?
Yes.
James Baker was Secretary of State. What was the United States position on this? I mean, in theory, you would think we're on board. Were we?
We were on board, but what was interesting, there was this euphoria in 88, especially in that moment of the falling of the wall earlier in Poland when Solidarity won the elections and formed the first non-communist government. But George Bush Sr., was very cautious in his pronouncements. And some people were saying, oh, why isn't he making a bigger deal out of this? And James Baker, his Secretary of State, was also very low key about it. But he understood quite early that this was putting Gorbachev in a very difficult position. And there was fear that that the Soviet Union might move against it, try to stop this whole thing. And maybe not Gorbachev personally, maybe there would be military people, but even Gorbachev was a bit of an unknown factor in terms of this. And he specifically told Gorbachev when he met him in December, right after the fall of the wall, he said, my administration will seek to avoid doing anything that would damage your position in the world. In other words, we're not going to gloat. But on the other hand, he also was convincing him, don't stand in the way of this. Germany will become unified, and you're better off with a unified Germany within NATO, within Western structures, than with some sort of maverick state, which are semi-fractured state, which who knows what will come of it. And that was a hard sell for Gorbachev internally, but Bush and Baker very effectively lobbied for it, and working also with Helmut Kohl, the German chancellor, West German chancellor, who went also to Moscow to try to reassure Gorbachev and the Russians to make this transition happen without any major confrontation.
So, as you mentioned, the German chancellor, Helmut Kohl, did move very quickly toward reunifying West Berlin and East Berlin. But what was the ultimate effect of that? I mean, that couldn't have been as smooth as we anticipate it might have been, no?
Well, of course, there were huge obstacles to overcome. You had two parts of that. They were both Germany, but parts of the country, but they had been under totally different economic systems. Their standards of living were radically different. For instance, one of the things, how did you merge the currency? The West German Mark at the time was the currency in West Germany, very strong currency. The East German currency, like all of the Eastern European currencies, were virtually worthless. But so one of the things Kohl's government did was say, okay, we are going to allow East Germans to exchange their East German marks, which are basically worthless, on a one-to-one basis for West German marks. So some quick fixes like that, which cost a lot. They ended up spending a huge amount of money on trying to integrate East Germany. And a lot of it, some of it was clearly wasted too and not handled very well. But overall, it was a huge gamble that worked. And it was also a gamble that a unified Germany has to be anchored in a more unified Europe. Kohl saw both of these things as coming together, and that's why he became such an advocate very quickly to integrate it, not only East Germany with West Germany, but to integrate the other former communist states into the European Union.
And looking beyond the EU and the United States, 1989 was also the year of the Tiananmen Square protests. Tell us about some of the parallels there, the connection between the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Tiananmen Uprising.
Well, one of the real jolting juxtapositions was the Polish elections, the first semi-free Polish elections, which were that great breakthrough, this what are known as the Solidarity elections, happened on June 4th, just as almost the same newscast shifted to the violence in Tiananmen Square. And it showed just what a difference it made in terms of whether the communist authorities were going to fight those seeking a better life and a freer life, or they were going to try to manage the changes and give way to the changes if they had to. And that was the difference between China and the Soviet Union. So I think it increased the fears of, getting back to, say, to George Bush and James Baker about managing the Russians well so that we did not get a Tiananmen Square type reaction to what was going on in particularly in Germany at the end of the year. The only violent place in Eastern Europe on a large scale in 89 was Romania, where they had a very, very, very rigid communist regime under Nicolae Ceausescu, a classic despot. And it was no accident that was the one place where the revolution was violent, and Ceausescu was deposed and executed along with his wife.
Andrew Nagorski spent more than three decades as a foreign correspondent and editor for Newsweek. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Thank you.